Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this roundtable discussion hosted by the Brookings Tsinghua Center for Public Policy. My name is Tia, and I'm wearing two hats today. Some of you know I'm a professor here at School of Public Policy and Management, and now I have a new hat. And as the director of Brookings Tsinghua Center, this is my first week on the job, and I'm very excited about having this event. And today we're having a discussion among friends. And let me just quickly introduce the speakers today. We have three speakers. First of all, Dr. David Dollar, and many of us know him just about 10 years ago when he first came to Beijing representing the World Bank as a director, a country director for China and Mongolia. And the good news is last year he joined Brookings Institution in Washington, the foreign policy program, and also based in the John Cornyn China Center. And for 4 years, I believe, David actually worked for the State Department.
Treasury Department.
The Treasury Department, but here, right?
Yeah.
In embassy. That's why it makes me very confusing. He's a very senior economist. He knows very well, extremely well, about the Chinese economy. And it worked that before he joined Brookings Institution. Second speaker today is Professor Bai Chung-an, and many of us know him extremely well, and he is the Freeman Chair Professor here in our neighbor School of Economics and Management, and he's also serving as the Associate Dean in that school. The school is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, and Professor Bai is a truly outstanding member from that that school. And Professor Bai holding many positions and public positions, including academic positions, and extremely well-respected economist here in this country. And our third speaker today is my colleague, Professor Tao Ran. And he is until last week, was serving as the acting director of Brookings Tsinghua Center. And now he's a non-residential senior fellow to the center, and continue to provide guidance, you know, to the work here in the BTC. And he's a very well-known economist, especially in the area of public economics and finance and the transition, Chinese economic transition. I myself, as a non-economist, I'm very impressed with his work on the urbanization and the interconnection between all different components. So this conversation is extremely timely now after the third plenum of the 18th Congress, and this economic reform has become such major issue just among the public, among the in the government, and also for the discussion in academia. And a lot of unanswered questions. And I guess one of the major concern is rebalancing the economy. So the economic reform and perhaps political reform as well, they may mention, and the balancing the Chinese economy, it will be the very focus today. And we'll go the format today. I will invite our speakers to speak roughly 10-15 minutes, really up to you. Then we open the floor for a roundtable discussion. And I'm not going to ask each one of you to introduce yourself right now, but at the discussion session, and when you have a question or comments, I do ask you to identify yourself before getting into the conversation. Without further ado, let me first invite David.
Okay, thank you very much. It's really a great pleasure to be here. I'm so happy that Chia has taken over as head of the Brookings Tsinghua Center, and I feel honored. Is this basically your
very first one?
Very first. Okay, so I came here for his first event, and it's great to be with friends Bai Chung'an and Tao Ran as well. As Chia said, I lived in Beijing for 9 years before moving back to Washington last summer, and I miss my life in Beijing in many ways. It's intellectually stimulating, and you get close to what's happening. And it's a little bit harder, of course, to cover it from Washington. So I want to start by saying that when I read the documents that came out of the third plenum, and when I read Premier Li Keqiang's speech to the National People's Congress, you know, I was very impressed. This seemed to be a pretty comprehensive plan of reform that would bring about China's rebalancing. But I've been in China for about a week now. I was in a conference together with Bai Chung'an and have had a chance to meet quite a few economists and policymakers. And so I have to say, after a week here, I'm a little bit less optimistic. And the theme of my opening remarks is that implementation is hard and opposition is strong. You know, Chinese have a lot of these pithy sayings, you know, Cheng Yu, we should have a Cheng Yu that says, I am not Chinese, it's not good enough to figure out what it would be, but it should mean something like, implementation is hard and opposition is strong. Is that an existing Cheng Yu?
Easier to know, it's more difficult to act.
Yeah, that, thank you, that's right. So let me, I want to just use my few minutes to take four, what I view as four important areas, probably the most important areas for reform, for rebalancing, and kind of draw out this theme of implementation is hard and opposition is strong. First, just a few words about why rebalancing is important. You know, China's been growing very well, but what's happened in recent years is there are a number of features of the growth model that I think are unsustainable. China's total factor productivity growth has slowed down. You know, that's a sign that there's less innovation, less technological advance. You know, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the manufacturing sector grew very well, but has now reached probably the maximum size it can reach in the economy. China has been very investment heavy, so the investment rate has risen up above 50% of GDP. And as you'd expect in that situation, the return to capital is now coming down. And so it's a problem to sustain growth based just on investment because there are diminishing returns, the productivity of capital goes down, and it's hard to even if you sustain the investment, you won't grow as fast. And then it's hard to sustain the investment because you look around and there seems to be a lot of excess capacity in different sectors, so there's not so much incentive to keep investing. And then a third feature of the Chinese economy is that consumption is very low, particularly household consumption. It's only about a third of the economy. So, in my view, China needs a set of reforms, an interrelated set of reforms that, on the one hand, would stimulate more productivity growth and technological innovation, and then at the same time would rein in or bring down the wasteful investment. And then as investment comes down, you're really needing consumption to rise. You know, if your investment is coming down, you really have only two possibilities. Either your external surplus is rising, which will be a problem for the rest of the world, or your consumption is rising. So just be frank, as an American, we would like to see China's consumption rising, not the external surplus rising. So I thought the third plenum and the premier's speech did touch on some important areas that interrelate and would address these different issues. So here, in my list of four, I'll just mention them briefly and then I'll go a little bit into each one. So my list of priority reforms would be first, opening up the service sectors to competition. Second, financial liberalization. Third, hukou reform. And fourth, fiscal reform. And I'll just briefly, I think I can indicate why they're interrelated. But let me start with opening up the services. I think the manufacturing sector in China is really quite competitive. It's had a lot of technological advance, but it's reached about its maximum size as a share of the economy. As economies develop, there are a variety of reasons why the service sectors come to take a larger and larger share of GDP. And in China, I see the service sectors, many of them, as being uncompetitive, relatively closed, these are the sectors where state enterprises still dominate. So financial, I normally think of financial services, telecom, media, logistics, but Chinese friends have been reminding me that education and health are other good examples. And when I say closed, I mean largely closed to private investment and very closed to foreign investment. So China stands out, among all the members of the G20, China is the most restrictive in terms of foreign investment in these service sectors, with the possible exception of Saudi Arabia, which we don't normally hold up as a model of good economic policy. Now, you see there in the premier's speech, he talks about opening up services, and this is something we've heard for a while, but I think that it seems to me that there's quite a strong opposition. You still have a lot of powerful state enterprises. They're fairly profitable. They're connected to line ministries. One of the things we've discussed in our U.S.-China relation is a bilateral investment treaty, which I think would be a very good step forward. This would require China to open up most of those sectors. Bilateral investment treaty would be negotiated on the basis of a negative list. China has started the Shanghai Free Trade Zone as a pilot to start, looking at the approach of a negative list. But if you look at the draft documents that are being prepared, the initial negative list that's being considered is very, very long. I'm told it has 190 sectors on it. Okay, so to me, that's an example of the strong opposition. You've got a lot of sectors in China where the relevant state enterprises and line ministries do not want to open up. It's kind of a collective action problem, right? Everybody would prefer that all the other sectors open up so that we get more productivity growth and dynamism, but if you're a powerful state enterprise, you don't want your own sector to be opened up. So I do think a bilateral investment treaty could be an important way to lock in reform, be very good for U.S.-China economic relations. But my sense is that the negotiations are moving very slowly, and the ball is really in China's court to figure out what would be a small, reasonable negative list to form the basis of these negotiations. Now, the second issue I want to mention is financial liberalization. And I think in a lot of ways, financial liberalization has started because I think of the development of shadow banking in China in many ways is quite a deliberate effort to start liberalizing the financial system first outside of the commercial banking sector. Right, so the shadow banking has more market-determined interest rates. There's a lot of lending to private sector activities coming through the shadow banking sector. The commercial banking system remains pretty tightly controlled. Interest rates are controlled by setting the deposit interest rate. And Governor Zhou has talked about reforming those interest rates within 2 years, but this is something China's talked about for a long time, reforming the interest rates. So I think allowing shadow banking to develop was a clever strategy, but it's actually grown pretty explosively. So now it's creating some risks for the system because it is less regulated, and it's grown very quickly, and it's become a very large share of the financial system. So I see the plan now. So on the one hand, the plan is, as Governor Zhou says, is to liberalize interest rates in the formal banking system, introduce deposit insurance so households know that the banking sector is conservative and safe, and now they're obviously allowing some bankruptcies to occur, some defaults in the shadow banking system. Again, that's basically good. That's part of capitalism. Is that some companies will go bankrupt and some of the lending products associated with that will default. But it is this is a good example of where I think the implementation is hard, because the central bank is worried that if it liberalizes interest rates too quickly and if interest rates rise, there are a lot of local governments and state enterprises with a large amount of bank lending, and all of a sudden, if you let interest rates rise too much, you're going to be encouraging a lot of bankruptcies. And so there are risks of the stability of the financial system. So I respect that this is hard. But the problem they face is if you don't liberalize interest rates, I view the cost of capital in the formal banking system to be still quite low in China. And so that's one of the factors that's been influencing a lot of investment and, frankly, some excessive and some bad investment. My third area of reform is HUCO reform. So I was very happy to see in Premier Lee's speech talking about giving 100 million urban residencies, so essentially 100 million urban HUCO, which is a good number to start. I didn't see a time frame, but I think once you announce something like that, you know, you can't delay it forever. So that's good. I view the problem is that, as I understand it, these will mostly be HUCO for smaller second and third tier, probably not even second tier cities, but smaller cities. And the big productivity gain China would get would be from letting more labor move to the most productive locations. You know, so migration normally is attracted by jobs. A lot of the jobs are going to be in first tier cities along the coast, and that seems to remain controversial. There seems to be a lot of local government opposition and frankly, maybe local population opposition to having a large inflow of migration into the first tier cities. And then that relates to my last issue, which is fiscal reform. I think one of the reasons local government resists the HUCO reform is they're worried they'll have a big influx of migrant families. They'll be expected to provide a full range of social services, but in fact, they won't have the resources to do that. Now, I think China overall has plenty of tax collection. You know, they're different numbers, but I think of the China's tax collection as being up above 30% of GDP, which is very healthy for a developing country. So I think there's plenty of revenue, and the issue to me is there's a mismatch between most of the revenue being collected by the central government and most of the expenditure occurring at the local level. And I think, you know, as I understand it, there are ad hoc transfers every year that make the system work, but it's reasonable for local government to worry that they're going to get a lot of migrants, but they don't have a reliable source of revenue. So tax reform, there are obvious things you could do with tax reform. The two most obvious ones to me would be the value-added tax is the big source of revenue. It's collected by the central government. It would be easy to formally divide that. You could just start by dividing it 50-50 between the central government and the local government. That would give the local government a very reliable source of revenue. And then I would be in favor of introducing a property tax. I think in most countries, that's an important source of local government revenue, and it would have the added benefit in China of discouraging the hoarding of apartments that we see. Now, as I mention each of these reforms, I see some people smiling because you can just imagine who the opposition is. You know, I mean, most urban HUCO residents own apartments, often many apartments, and so I think property tax is controversial. The central government seems reluctant to formally give up revenue collection to the local government, even though most of the expenditure is at the local level. So as I say, I look at these key reforms. I see a good plan coming from the technocrats, but I also see a lot of opposition, and frankly, some of these reforms are quite difficult to implement. So I just want to finish by saying that the maximum benefit comes from pursuing all these reforms together. Sort of think in very simple terms, you know, the HUCO reform should free up migration and allow more labor to move to high productivity jobs and locations. You need a well-functioning financial system to finance the investments that are needed in that context. As people move, you need the fiscal revenue so that the government can provide services at the location where they are. And then in my view, you're going to find more and more of your growth is in the service sectors, and you need open, competitive service sectors if you're going to get productivity growth and a healthy rate of growth. So I remain optimistic that there's a clear reform agenda for China. But again, I see that the reform, the implementation is hard, opposition is strong. And then the last thing I'll say is it's clear the economy is slowing down this quarter. I normally don't worry too much about quarter to quarter, but growth is clearly slowing down this quarter. So there's also an important debate going on about whether or not there should be some new stimulus, you know, which in a lot of ways is continuing the old growth model. You know, what additional investment projects can help growth in the short run, but that's just kicking the reform down the road. Or do you move ahead more aggressively with reform, but recognize that in the short run, you know, growth will slow down. That may be part of the adjustment process of moving to a new growth model. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, David. All right. David remains optimistic, even though you're less optimistic than a week ago. All right, because implementation is hard, as always, and the opposition is strong, and David proposed reform for different areas. And we'll come back for a discussion on that. But now let's invite Professor Bai.
David has given a very comprehensive analysis. My first reaction is to shut up and just open the floor for discussion about David's points. Then my second reaction is try to look at the same issues from a slightly different angle. I would like to offer one way to look at some of these issues. This is very much related to my current research. One problem with researchers is that they are often obsessed by their research ideas, so they focus on one angle and look at things. I'm going to do that. So this is a disclaimer. It doesn't mean this is the only angle one should take to look at the Chinese economy, but I think this is a very useful angle. I would like to start off by making a few observations about the Chinese economy, which are well known. And I would like to offer one way to explain all these observations. Then from this way of looking at things, there are implications for policy. One of the observations is that our savings rate is very high. Everybody knows that. Our investment rate is also very high. And the second observation is that despite of the abundant supply of capital, the cost of capital is very high as well. You would think that if you have taken economics 101, you would think that given the demand, when the supply is abundant, the price should be low. But we have abundant supply of capital, but price for capital is very high. And if you look at the average bank lending rate, this is published by PBOC quarterly, the average bank lending rate is about 7%. That's 1 year long, 7%. It may not sound that high, but if you consider that these firms who are borrowing money also face deflation, producer price index has been in deflation for many, many months, many, many quarters. Then the real cost of capital to these firms is even higher than the nominal cost. So this is the second thing. These two phenomena, high savings rate and high cost of capital, seem to be contradictory. The third observation is that actually David mentioned this, the rate of return to capital has been declining, and now it's fairly low compared to the cost of capital. We have been doing the estimates for the rate of return to capital for many years. In the middle 90s, the after-tax real rate of return, that is after price adjustment, was about 15%, but now it's around 5-6%. So the trend is very clear, and now even the level is starting to worry me. So this is the third observation. This seems to be also contradictory to the high investment rate. When you don't generate high rate of return, why do you invest so much? The fourth observation is that there is a very big change in the labor market in the last few years. Before 2008, a lot of people talked about the stagnating wages for migrant workers. But since then, the wages for migrant workers grew very fast. it's the average growth, annual growth rate is more than 12% after you subtract inflation rate, the real rate of return for migrant worker wage, real growth rate for migrant worker wage is still higher than real GDP growth rate. On the other hand, college graduates find it difficult to find jobs. And growth rate for more educated labor force, the growth rate for the wages of more educated labor force is much slower than that for migrant workers. One example, I did this, I just want to look at two extreme cases. One is the construction sector, which employs mostly migrant worker, construction sector. The other is the IT sector. There seem to be a lot of some students here. Many of the students, especially from this university, would end up working in the IT sector. And the first impression in China will be that the IT sector is doing extremely well. We are talking about all the IT products, right? You have your phone, you use WeChat all the time, and this is a locally developed firm, etc. And all the most prominent CEOs are IT CEOs, Ma Yun, Ma Baten, etc. So you would think that the IT sector is doing extremely well. But if you look at the data, the share of IT sector in GDP has been declining. This was a surprise to me when I first did it. And also, I was talking about the wage. The relative wage of construction workers to IT employees was declining as well. And 5 years ago, the relative wage was 2.8 times. That is, an average IT employee earns about three times as much as an average construction worker. But now it's 2.2 times. That happened only in a few years. So it's a fairly significant change. So I talked about these four phenomena. Is there an explanation, a unified explanation for these phenomena? I'm going to offer that explanation. My model of the economy is that you can divide the economy into two sectors. One sector has easier access to capital. The other sector has more difficult access to capital. The first sector, you can think of the first sector as consisting of the infrastructure sector. Infrastructure investment is very much encouraged by the government. It's easier to get financing. And real estate. Real estate, although it's becoming more difficult for real estate companies to get financing, but still they are able to attract a large amount of capital. Then, on the other hand, you have the sector that have more difficult access to capital. Possibly IT is one. We hear these firms getting IPO, they seem to raise a lot of money, but we only look at the successful firms. A lot of smaller firms find it very difficult to get capital. So if you have these two sectors, if the first sector, which has easier access to capital, mostly employee low-skill worker, unskilled labor, let's say migrant workers. The second sector employs not only migrant workers, they also employ college graduates. This is an oversimplified model of the economy. But in order to make things clear, I offer this oversimplified view. So the first sector is easier, find it easier to get capital. They do attract a lot of capital. And so they make a lot of investments that create demand, very high demand for migrant workers. And indeed, you see the wages for migrant workers rise and rising fast. Then the second sector, it's more difficult for them to get capital. So their development is sort of slowed down. And so that slows down the demand for skilled labor. So that's why the wages for skilled labor grow slower and college graduates find it more difficult to find jobs. Some would say, no, this is complete nonsense. the reason why you have this relative change in relative wages is because in 2004, we have expanded college enrollment by a big margin that creates more supply of college graduates. That obviously will suppress the wages for IT sector and that boosts wages for construction. But if that's the story, then you will see the IT sector prosper because they can employ abundant supply of low-cost college graduates that will help their development. But the real thing, the fact is they don't develop very fast. Their share in GDP is actually slowing. So the story, the explanation based on college enrollment expansion is not the only story. My story seems to at least to be a complement to that story. So that's my view of the, my angle of looking at the economy. How is this view? So that, given that model, you can easily understand why when there's abundant supply of capital, the price of capital is so high. Because this first sector, the infrastructure, the real estate, and other sectors, they find it easier to get credit. They don't, so they attract a lot of capital. There is a crowding out effect. When the first sector attracts a lot of capital, the second sector doesn't get a lot of capital. So they find that it's difficult to get capital, they also need to pay a very high price for capital. So that's one, that explains one of the phenomena I just mentioned. And we have a model, our model also predicts that given this structure of the economy, you would have high savings rate, high investment rate, and low consumption rate. We build a macro model to analyze this. So this model seems to be able to explain a lot of phenomena in the a lot of the problems in the structure of our economy. So how are these related to the issues raised by David? Actually, every issue he mentioned is related to this. For example, the service sector. The service sector would be in my second category. They find it more difficult to get capital, so they don't develop as fast as we wish them to be. There are other issues. There are entry barrier, etc. But I believe capital, the difficulty of getting capital, is another area. So when you don't solve this imbalanced investment between these two sectors, service sector probably won't develop very well. Then financial sector. Why is it so difficult for the second sector to get financing? Partly because of government policy, partly because of the financial sector is not very mature. Our financial sector is very good at channeling capital into infrastructure, into real estate, but not very good at channeling financing into Alibaba, into Tencent. You all know that the first money raised by Alibaba or Tencent were all foreign money. It was not local support for them. So that's partly our financial sector problem. So we need to reform our financial sector so that all other real sectors have equal access to capital. Now given that our infrastructure sector is so much creates so much demand for labor, we need more labor, more migrant workers. But the hukou system, in some way, may hinder that flow of labor from rural to urban area. When that flow is hindered, the crowding out problem I mentioned, the cost of labor become too high, the second sector find it more difficult to develop. And fiscal. A lot of the investment in the first sector in infrastructure is very much related to fiscal policy. And every time I talk about investment, I cannot resist talking about this story. I went to this city in Inner Mongolia. I don't want to name that city. Everybody can guess. I was on this tour with with the CEO of a major construction company. And the CEO proudly pointed us to two bridges. He said that we built those two bridges. We were all puzzled why there were these two bridges, because there was no water. Then he said that there was a river has been planned. A river has been planned. The river is not there yet, but the bridges are there. This city, of course, is extremely rich because it's sitting on huge deposits of natural resources. The per capita fiscal revenue of this city is highest in China, but still, this city owes this construction company 2 billion yuan. Hmm. That's an extreme example, but that suggests that the first sector, when they are so easy to get capital, it's partly related to fiscal issues. And then there are a lot of other issues related to this as well. Rule of law, protection of intellectual property rights. The second sector, the IT sector, many of the entrepreneurs are not willing to make investment there because they worry about intellectual property rights. When that is a major worry, they don't invest as much there. So you get more investment in the first sector that creates employment for unskilled labor. That's a good thing. But if that phenomena, if you have when you create employment for the unskilled labor, at the same time you hurt the employment prospect for skilled labor, that's a big problem, because the second sector, for example, IT, is the future. When the future sectors are hurt, when they don't develop well, they don't get the chance to learn, they don't get the chance to accumulate experiences in the development of these sectors, learning by doing is really important. And on the top of that, it discourages people from getting education, because education doesn't pay off as much as before. So this model has a lot of long-term negative implications. So I'm basically repeating what David said, but I'm trying to offer a model to understand some of these issues, and this is not the model of the Chinese economy, but I believe it's a very useful model to understand the economy, to understand policy. And I will be happy to take questions after Professor Tao speaks.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you very much, Professor Bai. I find this fascinating. He started off with this observation that this paradox, when the capital supply is high, at the same time you find that the cost of capital is also very high, and he provides this, what I see, a beautiful synthesis and framework to explain how, you know, from this sectoral perspective, you know, why this is the case, and find it's extremely interesting, have a great explaining power, and related so closely with what David just talked about, the four different issues, and also I find it's perhaps also related to the prescription you put together over there. Very much look forward to the conversation. Already I find it's promised to be a great conversation over there. By the way, I see that paradox on capital is also in my view, a focus of what the Professor Tao's theory, you know, on this issue. And in your sectoral analysis, and I find some similarity in Professor Tao's theory when he was considering this, you know, infrastructure and urban infrastructure and the financial sector and you know, capital supply and so on urbanization related. And we previously, I'm sure he, I won't speak for him, he will have more to talk. Professor Tong, all right.
Nice to be here, and I learned a great deal from David and Professor Bai. And I want to raise an issue. When I read the policy documents by the Communist Party with the 18th, the third plenum of 18th, you know, past Congress, it's a very long document with perhaps over 300 items of reform. That's really puzzling. I was wondering how this document come, where does it come from? Right, I mean, I don't know how they worked, but you know, my guess is that you know, they do have scholars or you know, policy consultants from for every ministry, and then you have a central group that incorporates all these different you know, proposals. Sometimes you know, there's some conflicting, so you see a balanced talk there. But the question to ask is that the way to do reform? Do you do reform by making some very grand documents? But that's actually my problem with this kind of reform agenda. Because they're talking about almost everything. But you don't really know where they start. And how the earlier reform will pave the way for the next reform. So that's why reform has to be coordinated. But you also need to focus on something first that makes later reforms easier. I think that's actually a key issue that the Chinese reform need to address in the next few years. In practice, I mean, so let me just give some example. State-owned enterprise. There are some sectors that are over capacity. For example, raw material, energy, already huge over capacity, largely due to the 2008-2009 stimulus package. In that area, if there's over capacity, so what need to be done is to reduce the capacity, even if you deregulate the sector sales to private enterprises, maybe, you know, it has to be downsized. There's not much growth potential there. The key issue is how to make the production, you know, not to be cut down too fast. There's still some sectors that have under capacity. That I will name, you know, health, aviation, telecommunication, limited sectors. In this sector, and or petrochemical, if you deregulate, if you just or even you know issue more license to private sector, that will generate growth, competition, and more employment. Actually, I mean, as David mentioned, relatively high-end service sector. If you that's still monopolized by state-owned sector, if you open it to private sector, that will generate growth and employment. That's also my understanding why, you know, college graduates could not find good jobs, because they should go to this sector that's monopolized by the government, the state-owned enterprise. But in these sectors, you don't see much reform. They're talking about mixed ownerships. What does that mean? Mixed ownerships means that I will give you some minority shares for these government-controlled monopolies. But if I am a private entrepreneur with no connection, I dare not take it, because I will be a minority, you know, shareholder. I will have no say in the power decision process. Who will get it? Those who are well connected, who have good connection, and who dare to take a minority share and share the monopolistic profits with the state-owned sector. So that could only, so this will not generate growth, because it's does not generate competition. It only just sell the state-owned assets at cheap prices to some well-connected people. So that's not reform. That's anti-reform. That's a very wrong reform. So, there's another. Okay, I mean, let's get. I have actually have problem with China's financial reform. As David mentioned, you know, shadow banking is a kind of liberalization. but it's a very risky one, you know, because there's no good regulations there, and you don't know, you know, who want to pay high interest rates to borrow from shadow banking. Actually, it's a desperate real estate developer and local governments in inland area that has, you know, that want to borrow at higher interest rates. There was a selection there. Those who borrow at high rates, actually, they don't really care if they ever, you know, if they can't pay, they just go away. Or they just, you know, come to central government for rescue. So it seems to me that, you know, the central bank governor, Zhou Xiaochuan, want to leave his legacy, financial liberalization, which I think is a good target to achieve. But, you know, I think, you know, if there's, I'm not against financial liberalization. I would say financial liberalization without the real sector deregulation would be very risky. Actually, we saw that. We saw that, you know, you do the shadow banking. Because in most sectors, there's still open capacity. So there's no way to, you know, make investments in this sector and make money. If you only when you open the heavily regulated sector, I would suggest some, you know, government monopolies, and also the land sector. You could financial resources can go these sectors and make positive return. But now there's no such a way. So where do they go? They go to adding the financial cost of those heavy borrowers. Okay, so this is a Ponzi game. You know, that actually may not last very fast. I was wondering why, you know, the central bank has not installed a push ahead with the financial liberalization much earlier. For example, in 2006, 2008, okay, when the Chinese economy was still booming. You know, but now the situation is very different. Because as the central SOE and local government investment platform has borrowed huge money at cheap rates and made very bad investments. If you do financial liberalization, actually more or less you're inviting financial crisis to come. You're making the non-performing loans become very explicit. So think about, you know, what was going on in early 2000s in China. The Chinese banks was non-performing loan rate was perhaps as high as 30-40% in Chinese state banks. China was close to a banking crisis and economic crisis. So what happened is that you have a new growth engine of exports and real estate that generates growth and then consolidates the financial system. And then also they pay high taxes. The government also, you know, use some of the tax to fill the gaps in the state banking system. That means growth. Unless you find growth, new growth engines, you will have resources to address the potential huge non-performing loans in the banks. And only perhaps when your banking system, financial system become a little bit more consolidated, want to push ahead with financial liberalization. They could be done together, but at least you have to do some real sector reform. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, accompany it with some financial reform, but I actually don't see any reform in real sectors going on. I talked about state-owned enterprise, some government monopoly. Now I want to go, you know, talk about, you know, land and housing. As Stanley mentioned, Li Keqiang is trying to push ahead with hukou reform. One great limitation is that they limit the hukou to small and medium-sized cities. But even for small and medium-sized cities, there's a problem there, because China's migration is largely from inland to coastal areas. Many smaller and medium-sized coastal cities that take a lot of migrants. They're still working there. Of course, that is not a huge number. But these coastal migrants residing coastal cities, they already erect very high entry barriers for migrant workers. I see no government, central government intervention into this, hukou system. Actually, usually set up the so-called point accumulation system. You have to reach some criteria to ever become a, local permanent resident. And even if you become a permanent local resident, okay, so what that help you? Perhaps only the children's education, no housing. Okay, they will tell you that, we probably, in the future will provide you with public housing. At least it's never going to happen. I saw Li Keqiang's, stimulus package, every time when the economy slows down, they push ahead with public housing. The local government have no incentive to do this, even for their permanent residents, not to mention migrant workers. Local governments are already hugely in debt. Building large-scale public housing will lower their income revenue from land leases because the more housing supply there will also add into their cost. And this is not an incentive-compatible policy at all, and I never imagine that constructing public housing for 200 million or 300 million migrant workers will ever be possible, physically possible for China. That's the wrong way of reform, and actually it's a waste of money. In most cases, what you need to do is to reform the land system so that farmers in suburban areas, in migrant receiving cities, can build housing legally. Migrant workers. That's what you do with, that's what you will call a market reform. Okay, this public housing is an anti-market reform. It could not be done. But this kind of land reform I talked about, in China actually, if you look at land use structure in cities, it's very, very distorted. In most countries, when they urbanize, they use 70% of the new land for residential housing, to accommodate migrants. They use only 10-15% of their land for industrial purpose. In China, cities use 50% of the land for industrial parks, and only 30% of the land for residential development, and only 1% of 200 million migrants can afford to purchase house in the cities. Usually not in the cities that they work, but in cities of their home county. So what you need to do is to break the government's monopoly of the land so that suburban farmers in migrant receiving cities can supply housing land, residential land, or even build rental housing, freely. But this reform is also very difficult, not only because local government strongly oppose them, that would affect their, revenue from land leasing for residential and commercial land, but also because there's already a very serious housing bubble. Okay. If there was no monopoly of this land, the bubble will not be so serious in the first place. But if the bubble is already there, now if you start land reform by breaking the monopoly, the bubble may burst tomorrow or today when people hear that there will be reform. So this is a very difficult reform to do. You have to do it very carefully. And actually, my proposal is that, to allow suburban farmers to first build only rental housing that could not be sold on the market, so that it will help to ease the bubble, but will not break the bubble, okay? And this will target only the migrants, the 200 million migrants workers and their family members, you know, and build house that will boost growth, that will generate income, tax, and also, you know, boost demand for the oversupplied steel and cement in China, and a lot of SOEs, you know, producing this is going to bankrupt. Even that policy, I mean, I actually worked with the Ministry of Land and Resources on this, they're not going to take it because the local government just think the current game can still go on. Okay, and you saw, actually, I went to inland area. After 2009, after the worst financial crisis, industrial land leasing actually increased by 30 to 40% before the pre-financial crisis level. Well, I mean, there's industrial, so there's two bubbles here in China. One is housing bubble, secondly is industrial park bubble. Actually, this was very, it's still happening on huge scale in inland China. Local governments borrowed huge money to build this industrial park that no one will ever come. So I think China should have some reform in this government monopolized sector that still have under capacity, very limited sector, and also land sector. But this a very difficult reform to do, and I don't think they're going to do it. And what I saw is that you know, the housing bubble is starting to burst in some third or fourth tier cities already this year. When that happens, there will be, you know, increasing non-performing loans in the banking sector, that the bank will further contract the lending, reduce the lending, and finally leading to a bubble burst in first tier cities. So I'm actually not optimistic. I will stop.
All right. Well, thank you. Here, Professor Hall is actually agreeing to some extent to what David proposed, right? Except he's less optimistic on these issues. And 300 items of reform put on there, and perhaps going in the wrong way, and every time there is an economic slowdown, there is a push on public housing, which does not work, to his observation. And he proposed this land reform, which is probably in addition to the list that David and Professor Bai was talking about. And even though Professor Bai was not that pessimistic, and I think many of our graduate students in the audience may be dismayed when hearing about their wages so not expected to grow as fast as the migrant workers. And between all three of them, and they showed us today in why sometimes economics is called the science of dismay. I'm sure you're agreeing with me. You're actually listening and speaking to some of the best minds in economic thinking here you can find in town. And not always bad news is. I hear that that housing bubble is actually the good news to many of us here, right? So those who have not bought their houses and wait for the bubble. Let's open the floor for a discussion now. And your questions, your comments, please do limit within 1 minute, maybe just here as diverse as possible expression here for this roundtable conversation. Raise your hand. Identify yourself. You go first, please.
Maybe we should take a few before we speak.
Yes, again, huh? All right. That's a good idea.
Thank you very much for your speech. My name is Camilla, and I'm a student here at the School of Public Policy. The focus of my research is policy experimentation. And according to my findings, in the last 3 years, China has started to implement heavily in many of the sectors that you have mentioned, such as liberalization of services, insurance, and telecommunication, energy. My question is, what is your take in that, and can policy experimentation be a solution, like instead of promoting one model of liberalization of services, implementing different local policies could be a solution for the problems we have mentioned? Thank you.
All right, well, Camilla, you just choose the wrong area of study. Implementation is hard. Right, let's take a few more questions from the audience before. Is that question addressed to David?
Professor Tao.
Professor Tao, okay. All right, other, yes, please, identify yourself.
My name is Gordon, and I'm a student at Tsinghua University. My question is about the policy implications for Professor Bai's comments on different sectors. So, can you speak more detailedly about how to protect IT sectors and sectors like those who cannot get access easily to capital?
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Yes,
yeah, here. Has been contributing a lot to the e-commerce and the retail consumption, and with that boost, the consumption in China, or it wouldn't really matter to the whole economic landscape in China for the future 5 to 10 years.
Well, thank you. David, would you like to go first?
So on that last question, my understanding is this internet banking, I think of this as part of the shadow banking system.
Yeah.
So it's a good example of an innovation that they're allowing outside of the formal banking system, and in many ways that's good. But part of the reason it's spreading quickly is it's not really, up till now, it has not been regulated as a bank. So, you know, when you put your deposit in the bank, China has very high reserve requirements. You put money in the bank, and the bank has to put 20% of it aside in the central bank, which actually creates a quite a bit of security in the Chinese banking system. With the internet banking, as I understand it, they can just lend it all out. Yeah. So it's sort of a nice innovation, but frankly, it's risky. My understanding is they're going to give banking licenses now to Alibaba, I think, and Tencent, and I'm not sure exactly how it's going to play out, but I do think it's in China's interest to bring, you know, that's clearly banking, so bring that back into the regulated sector. But then I would also proceed with deregulation. So I would move ahead cautiously with interest rate liberalization, because if you just pull it inside the existing regulated system, you sort of kill all the dynamism of that new innovation. So it'd be nice to keep that as a competitive private sector banking, but it should be within the regulatory framework, or else it creates big risks.
Professor Bai, your take on that?
Yeah, I probably cannot say much about internet banking because it's a very complicated issue. As I agree with, in general, with what David said, I think innovation is important. But the proper regulation for financing, regulation is always necessary because you are using other people's money to make decisions, and you don't fully internalize the potential risk with your decision. So some kind of regulation is important. But I don't know the technical details, so I cannot offer what kind of regulations there should be. About the policy implications about what I said, I think that model worked well when there was a abundant supply of raw surplus labor. In economics, we say that there is some externality. Especially with rural to urban migration, I think externality can be very important. When you are the first person to migrate out of the village, it's really difficult in the city in an urban area, you don't know anyone, you know, there is no social network supporting you. But if you are if there are already many people in your village who have already migrated, it's easier. So there is some positive externality in rural to urban migration. In economics, we usually when there is externality, you would you either use subsidy or tax or etc. to deal with it. So in that case, subsidizing sectors which are unskilled labor intensive makes sense. However, I believe we have already passed that stage. Now, subsidizing that those sectors no longer makes sense from the employment perspective. So if that's the case, then one implication of the model is that stop subsidizing those sectors. But that's very difficult because there, in the long run, that should be what we did. But in the short run, people worry about if you stop some of these infrastructure investments, will there be a hard landing? There's some trade-off between short-run considerations and long-run ones. So in principle, I would say we should reduce economic stimulus. David mentioned this. I think many people don't consider this part of the cost of the stimulus. That is, when you stimulate the economy, usually you are stimulating unskilled labor-intensive sector. This year, the stimulus focused on railway investment and subsidized housing, urban subsidized housing. In both of these sectors, they employ a lot of unskilled labor. And when that happens, the cost of unskilled labor will rise even further. That hurts other sectors. That a lot of exporting firms find it very difficult to compete because labor costs for them rise very fast. And when labor is not put into these productive use, if labor, I'm not saying infrastructure investment is unproductive, but they probably, after so many years of investment, and those productive investments are sort of exhausted. It's more difficult to identify productive investment. I'm not saying there is no productive investment anymore in infrastructure, but it's more difficult to identify productive investment there. So if you still stimulate that sector by then attract a lot of labor away from these more productive sectors, that's a huge efficiency loss. So that's one implication. There are other possible implications as well. Let me just stick to this one.
Thank you, Professor Tao.
Yeah, actually, I didn't get your question. So can you
policy implementation? Your
policy
question.
Experimentation.
Yeah.
And what you have mentioned, and also Professor Geller mentioned, as essential reform to be achieved, they have been implemented at experimental level. All the things, the liberalization of services, has been done, but only at experimental level. And my question is, what do you think about policy experimentation? And what would policy experimentation be an alternative solution to the implementation of one big liberalization policy?
Policy experimentation.
That depends on which sector, actually.
For example, there are some land reforms in Guangdong that actually I think I have been working on that with local governments, which I think their experiences, I mean, allowing, you know, small property rights housing to gradually be legal after some, you know, redevelopment, that actually would be a very good policy to recommend to other cities so that they can, that will help accommodate the migrant workers. there are also some, you know, policy experimentations that probably may not be easily expected. For example, I mean, David mentioned about, you know, property tax. They have experimented with this in two cities, where they find that, you know, the collecting cost is higher than the revenue that they get. And also, in the short term, okay, actually, you know, there are many people who want to sell their house. Actually, maybe, you know, I believe the government will not implement, you know, property tax in the short term because they're very worried about the burst of the bubble. I mean, another example is Shanghai Free Trade Zone. Actually, I cannot give you very blunt, I only have some examples. You know, it could be, you know, a good way that China opens service sector to other countries, both domestically, to foreign and domestic investors, if you can do that. But it could only also be a channel that rich people in China get their money out of China more easily. You know, actually, I think, you know, both could happen, depending on how you experiment it.
Can I just add two sentences on this?
Sure,
because you know, China has a long history of using policy experimentation. It's often worked very well, and Tao Ran just gave some examples where it might work. But I do think some of the service liberalization is very hard to do as a geographic pilot. You know, because things like telecom are inherently national services, or take express package delivery, for example, as another service sector. It would be very hard to localize that. You know, if your business model is to deliver packages around Beijing, it's not much of a business model, right? You want to develop a network and deliver packages all over China, sort of telecom. So I think a lot of these services, it's very hard to have a geographic pilot. You could have a pilot in the sense of, let's open up package delivery, which is just one, you know, service sector, and see what happens. That would be, you know, that'd be a sectoral pilot.
Great. Let's get another round of questions. I see a hand here. Thank you. Peace. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm a student for law school, and I have two small questions. The first one is for Professor Donald. And my question is, what's your opinions about the mixed ownership for the state-owned enterprises? Because I think it's kind of a way for the state ownership to escape their crisis of because they are short of money, so they ask the private capital to contribute money, but the state still has a final say about their daily operations. And my second question is about debts. I think that maybe the local governments would have a very serious debt because they do not have the right to collect the value-added tax, and maybe the small enterprises do not have enough money because the money flows to the state-owned sectors. So do you think this will create very serious crisis maybe in 2 or 3 years? And will this crisis will result in very serious problems for the banking system of China? Thank you.
Thank you. Can we have another? Professor Zhu.
My name is Shifeng Zhu from the School of Public Policy and Management. I would like to ask Professor Bai about the current campaign of anti-corruption, in lots of economic fields such as financial system, land acquisition, oil and electricity. So would you please tell us something about the relationship between the anti-corruption campaign and the balance of economic issues? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Other questions before we move on? Okay, let's take the three questions, two on mixed ownership, the other one on anti-corruption. David, would you like to go ahead?
Sure. All right. Right, so there were two questions on mixed ownership. I personally am very skeptical that this is a good strategy for China, because if what I think is going to happen is the government's going to try to sell a minority share of some state enterprises to private investors. So that, as you yourself said, that will bring some money in, but I don't really think money is the big problem in China. It's not going to change the management of the companies. There'll be minority shareholders. So I just really don't see that you get much efficiency gain. To come back to the notion of policy experimentation, why not take one big state enterprise and completely privatize it? That would be a really interesting policy experiment. Because,
is there a particular one you would recommend?
I guess because I know so much about the banking sector, my instinct would be to take one of the big four, probably not the Ag Bank. Take one of the big three, not the Ag Bank.
Okay, ICBC.
Privatize ICBC as a policy experiment. That's a serious piece of advice. I don't think you'll get the kind of efficiency gain that you normally associate with privatization by partially selling these firms, selling minority shares. And then the other question that I think was relevant for me is concerns the local government debt. And I think the government's made a good effort to really come up with estimates of the local government debt that's really, in a sense, the government debt. So what's been financing infrastructure through local government infrastructure companies? It's true local governments have a lot of state enterprises, but I think it's legitimate to treat that as a separate issue. So if you take these estimates of government debt and you add up the central and the local government debt together, it is not an alarming number. It's a number in the range of 50% of GDP, which is very manageable and which for an American sounds very small, or for a European sounds very small. So I don't think the public debt problem is alarming in China, but I worry it's grown very rapidly. So if there's more rounds of stimulus, Professor Bai mentioned the rail and the local housing, and some of my co-panelists feel that the housing is not productive. So there is a risk that you'll continue to build up this debt and that there won't be very good assets on the other side of the balance sheet. So I worry about the future, but I don't worry that the level is a problem right now. More worrying is the corporate debt has risen very rapidly, and the corporate sector is very highly leveraged in China. Both the state enterprises and the private sector are very highly leveraged. So if there were a banking problem, I would expect it to start in the corporate sector. And then the question is, will the government just let many of these firms go bankrupt, including local state enterprises? You can imagine. I have an easier time imagining what I think of as the real crisis in China, meaning the growth rate slows down because the investment is not efficient and they're not doing the kind of reforms we've talked about. So I can imagine a growth crisis. It's harder for me to imagine a banking crisis in China because I think it's a closed system, controlled interest rates, very high reserves that I mentioned. So it has a lot of conservative features. So I don't worry about a banking crisis the way that some observers worry.
Purpose of bank?
Maybe the debt won't cause a banking crisis in the traditional banking sense, but some of the shadow banking institutions may be exposed to much more risk than the big banks, the trust companies, etc. It's not just because of lack of regulation. I think when we talk about shadow banking, there's often a suggestion that the problem arises from lack of regulation. But sometimes it could be a result of improper regulation. For example, for the formal banking sector, they need to be well regulated because the depositors are very diverse. for some of the trust products, they specifically say that they are only sold to so-called qualified investors. These investors are rich and supposedly sophisticated, and they are able to absorb risk. So they should, there are investments that are risky. We need to make risky investments. If we only make safe investments, we won't have technological progress. So those shadow banking institutions should play that. They should not replicate what the formal banking do. Formal banking does. They should lend to a different sector. But often they are bounded. They are prevented from doing that because, for example, if one of their products get into default situation, they may risk losing their license. The license is really important too. So why don't let them take some risk? Why don't let those so-called qualified investors take some risk? So I think there, although there is no formal regulation to force these trust companies to make all the payment to not to default, but there are a lot of implicit rules that make it very difficult for them to default on any of their product. And I think because of this, because they cannot default, so they have to borrow new money to pay back the old project, risk accumulates. I think that's a potential risk. I agree with you. I don't think the formal banking sector is going to get into a crisis situation. But these trust companies may be facing a lot of risk. Mm-hmm. So that's about the debt issue. The other issue is about the relationship between anti-corruption and the economic structure. That's a very good question. I have speculations, but I don't have hard evidence. One speculation is that corruption is easier when you engage in big projects. It's harder to have to collect rents from street vendors. It's easier to collect rents from a huge construction company. So that could be a reason why you have all these strong proposals for investment. And again, this is speculation. I only have anecdotal evidence. For example, the former mayor of Nanjing got into trouble, right? He was a strong promoter of all these infrastructure investment in the city. And why? At least in this case, there were kickbacks and there were corruption involved. It's hardly, I don't think he was so much interested in collecting bribes from small family-run restaurants. that's the service sector. And infrastructure? So that's my speculation. I'm afraid that that makes it harder to restructure.
Okay, thank you. Professor Tong, you have any comments on this? No, okay. Let's get a final round of questions, maybe one or two. Over here, yes. Okay, Fong, you have a question.
My question is actually not really related to some of the issues mentioned before.
Go ahead.
So it's on one of the changes in the last 1 or 2 weeks about how China is actually relaxing on the Chinese company acquisition of foreign companies. Like they're relaxing on the regulation that, for example, for a Chinese company don't have to submit a report on some of the foreign acquisition. And I would like to ask the Professor Doder on, because the topic for the event today is China reform agenda and its implications for China taking role in the world, especially the US-China relations. So what would this relaxing in foreign acquisition has on the China relationship with US Europe per se? And also the second question is on how is that actually has a changing in the manufacturing sector, because if they are acquiring more companies abroad, maybe the focus should be they can change the measure to actually GNP, because GNP, if it's GNP is growing, then you don't actually need to look at GNP anymore.
Okay, so get a question.
So China has emerged as a major supplier of foreign investment to other countries in the last few years, and I actually think this is an interesting and healthy development, kind of as some of the investment opportunities in certain sectors decline in China, it makes sense for Chinese firms to look in those sectors abroad. And there's been a big surge in Chinese investment into the United States in the last couple of years. So if you look at the total stock of Chinese investment overseas, if you leave aside Hong Kong, which is a special case, the United States is the largest destination for Chinese overseas investment. So we welcome it. As you know, certain transactions are controversial, but there have been some very big transactions like Shuanghui buying Smithfield and Chinese firm, I think it was Sinopec buying one of our energy companies. So in general, we feel the United States is quite open to foreign investment, and the changes you mentioned would essentially be deregulating the outbound investment from China, making it easier for small, medium, private firms to be going abroad. So I think that's very positive. But then I do have to say, again, that on the American side, we feel that many sectors are still quite restricted here in China, and I think it'll be harder for China to pursue this strategy of going outward if you're not reciprocally opening up, because you're going to find other partners around the world start to feel that this is unfair if your companies can come to the U.S. and buy our best producers of certain goods and services. You know, American firms are going to want to come here and expand as well, and I actually think it's in your interest to open up those sectors. So I hope we will negotiate this bilateral investment treaty I mentioned, which will create a better foundation for direct investment to flow in both directions.
Anything you want to add, Professor Bai?
Is this the last?
Mm-hmm.
I would like to say something that's not related addressing this specific question. I just want to make a remark before we end that today we discussed a lot of the problems. I also would like to emphasize that we did make a lot of progress. I have done some work on some social programs, for example, health care. In 2003, before 2003, there was no rural health insurance at all. Now, almost every rural resident enjoys some form of insurance. The coverage is not great, but it's much better than nothing. At that time, people thought that it was impossible to establish a rural health insurance coverage because the government needs to spend a lot of money, if not many people can really get bribes from it. But it happened. Initially, the subsidy was 40 yuan per person, now it's 320 yuan per person within 10 years. So I just want to have some balance. It's not that everything was terrible. We did achieve something. We did achieve. I think this is a significant achievement to offer health coverage to all rural residents, including migrant workers, Now urban residents are covered. Now we are starting piloting programs for pension, rural pension. And so there are experiments, there are progress, and even though we talk about a lot of problems, and I raise the importance of intellectual property rights, I do see a good prospect for progress there as well, as the need for innovation becomes more important. People will support better protection of intellectual property rights. And I think that's an important force. And eventually that force may push for significant improvement in that area as well. So I just, I've been talking about all these problems, but because I work in some of the areas, so I do feel strongly there's some reason for optimism.
Great. Well, thank you, Professor Bai, for that encouraging final note. That pretty much concludes our conversation, a roundtable discussion today. We have covered a lot on the economic reform and on the economic rebalancing. And there are many great ideas and even some great prescriptions for the way ahead. And we have come to a realization that implementation is not easy, and the opposition remains strong, yet we understand that any reform, no reform is easy, and not to say in such a big country, such a large economy, and optimism is needed, and we all need to remain optimistic and work toward that direction. And for that, I would like to thank our speakers today, David and Professor Bai and Professor Tao. And I would like to thank all of you who have asked great questions, and every one of you for your participating. Really, thank you. And I would also like to take this opportunity to thank my colleagues and who have put together this great event today. We have here Li Yuan to be recognized, and Xuelian over there, and where's Meng Yi? Somewhere, she's hiding somewhere. Well, thank you all very much. All right.